a key sponsor of the event, found the solution in an inspired introduction. Almost all of these Tibetan men who have joined us today have spent years in harsh prisons. The Communist Chinese Army not only imprisoned them for expressing their beliefs, but tortured them as well. Somehow they were released or able to escape from prison. Then, to find freedom, they walked across the Himalayas, the highest mountains on earth. Some tied rags on their feet because they had no good shoes. But even now they are in exile. They are forced to live far from their home, apart from their families and community, and they do not know if they will ever be able to return. What has kept them going through all of their struggle have been their songs and prayers, and this is what they will sing for you today. In an instant, the gospel choir and the Tibetan monks looked at one another with eyes that shared the vulnerable depths of human sorrow, and they found understanding. Each group sang to the other from the heart, and when their music was finished, they came together to hug and embrace like long-lost brothers. The songs these men sang expressed the emotions of their hearts, their struggles and capacity to endure, their hopes and aspirations for freedom and redemption were carried by their voices. Feelings are what connect us to life and to one another. To be able to feel is one of the extraordinary gifts of humanity. To neither suppress our feelings nor be caught by them, but to understand them, that is the art. Working with emotions after awakening. The Buddha taught we must become aware and accepting of the entire range of feelings, of pleasant, neutral, and unpleasant feelings as each arises. He went on, by becoming aware of the entire range of the emotions and experiencing the feelings in the feelings, we can find peace in their midst and become free. But the process does not stop after an experience of realization. One Buddhist teacher recalls her study with her Zen master. I was working on koans, and there were times I would go for an interview and couldn't even speak about my koan. I'd have to talk about my emotions because they were so central to my practice. Sometimes it was joy, but more often it would be the difficult feelings and struggles with my parents or in my relationship. He would listen and weep with me about it, and he would say, "Yes, I know how hard it is. It's like that sometimes in my family, too." I thought he wasn't supposed to say that. His openness to feeling my life would open my heart. He was so human in his willingness to be right there. I first met Buddhist teacher and psychiatrist Robert Hall in 1974. One of the chief proteges of Fritz Perls, he co-founded the Gestalt Institute in San Francisco in the 1960s. Then he began the Lomi School, one of the first trainings to combine spiritual work with that of the body and emotions. I was a new psychologist. I remember telling him that I was learning to diagnose the difficulties of those who came to me reasonably well, to recognize their problems and sort through their clinical history. But what I was still shaky about was how to best help them change. "Oh, I don't do that," said Robert. "You don't?" I asked incredulously. "No," he went on. "I help them to be with what is true. The healing comes from that." Without the ability to be present to our own feelings, we continue to blame our troubles on others, individually and collectively. As James Baldwin put it, I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hates so stubbornly is because they sense that once hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with their own pain. Only when we are permeable to what is true in us will our practice go forward. To encourage an awareness of inner emotional richness during retreats, I sometimes recite from a list of 500 feelings. These include affectionate, ambitious, ambivalent, amused, antagonistic, antsy, apathetic, appreciative, argumentative, blissful, broken-hearted, buoyant, calm, cheerful, claustrophobic, compassionate, concentrated, concerned, curious, delighted, depressed, disheartened, driven, ebullient, fearful, frightened, hateful, honored, humble, hysterical, glad, gluttonous, grateful, grave, greedy, jealous, jovial, joyful, pleased, pissed off, prudish, sad, silly, sleepy, sober, spacious, sympathetic, and so on. In the awakened heart, we find a capacity to touch all parts of this amazing feeling life with tenderness. As we begin to accept the rhythms and range of feelings, we bow to the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows of the Tao. Accepting inner and outer circumstances as they arise, the men and women of Tao did not fight their way through life. They took life as it came gladly. They did not, by their own contriving, try to help the Tao along. The mind and the heart. The jewel in the lotus is the translation of the universal compassion mantra Om Mani Padme Hum. While it has many meanings, one explanation of its symbolism is that compassion arises when the jewel of the mind rests in the lotus of the heart. The awakened mind has a diamond-like clarity. When this clear insight rests in the heart's tender compassion, both dimensions of liberation are fulfilled. In Buddhist psychology, mind and heart are often described by one word, citta. This heart mind has many dimensions. It contains and includes all our thoughts, our feelings and emotions, responses, intuition, temperament, and consciousness itself. When we speak of mind in the West, we usually refer only to the rational thought process. Observing this aspect of mind, we see an endless stream of thoughts, ideas, and stories. While this discriminating mind has a practical value, it can also separate us from the world. Our ideas easily create us and them, good and bad, past and future. Our thoughts also like to create imaginary problems. As Mark Twain put it, "My life has been filled with terrible misfortunes, most of which never happened." Or, in the words of one of my teachers, Sri Nisargadatta, "The mind creates the abyss, and the heart crosses it." Along with thoughts and impulses, Buddhist psychology also describes feelings as a natural aspect of heart and mind. Initially, we notice that pleasant, neutral or unpleasant feeling arise with each experience. If we notice them mindfully, without clinging to the pleasant or condemning the unpleasant, we can discover how these basic feelings give rise to a full range of emotions. Some people believe that emotions are dangerous, but the emotions themselves are rarely a problem. It is our lack of awareness of them, or the stories that we believe about them, that create our suffering. Without awareness, painful feelings can fester into addiction or hatred or degenerate into numbness. Eventually, we can lose touch not only with what is felt, but also with our heart's essential wisdom. As the 20th century Christian mystic Simone Weil noted, "The danger is not that the soul to doubt whether there is any bread, but that by a lie it should persuade itself that it is not hungry. The first woman I became involved with after I disrobed from being a monk was a college friend who was newly teaching at Harvard. Inside, I still felt like a monk who had no preferences for or against anything, taking whatever was put in the begging bowl. When she would ask what I wanted for dinner or what movie I'd like to see, I answered, "Whatever you like, dear, for me it doesn't matter." When she would ask how I felt about going out in the country or staying home, I said, "Oh, it's all okay with me." It drove her crazy. This wasn't just a wise spiritual detachment. She observed that I was afraid of engagement and out of touch with feeling, and reminded me that I had been that way before the monastery, too. It was true. I didn't know what I felt. So she got me a small notebook with the suggestion that I write down 10 things each day that I liked or disliked until I could start to know my own feelings. Recovering my feelings was a long and life-changing process. Feelings and temperament. Awakening to the emotions means to feel them, nothing less, nothing more. It does not require changing our feelings. Our feelings change all the time on their own. Nor does it mean changing our temperament. If we are intuitive or philosophical, sanguine or melancholic, that will likely remain the same. Our range may expand, but our temperament and personality will likely continue. One Buddhist teacher said that he had expected awakening to bring a personal transformation, only to be surprised that it was actually an impersonal transformation. The transformation is the opening of the heart and not a personality change. This teacher went on. In many ways, the spiritual transformation of the past decades is different than I'd imagined. I'm still the same quirky person, with much of the same style and ways of being, so that on the outside I'm not that amazingly transformed, enlightened person I first hoped to become. But there's a big transformation inside. Years of working with my feelings and family patterns and temper has softened the way I hold them all. In the struggle to know and deeply accept my life, it has been transformed, and my love has grown larger. If my life was like a crowded garage where I kept bumping into the furniture and judging myself, now it's like I've moved into an airplane hangar with the doors left open. I've got the old stuff there, yet it doesn't limit me like before. I'm the same, yet now I'm free to move about, even to fly. As we have seen earlier, it is a mistake to think we can evade our karma, the history of who we are. I saw this very clearly 20 years ago when I first taught a large retreat in Switzerland. Participants came from all over Europe. In private interviews with students, I tried to open to each individual without prejudice, regardless of his or her culture or country. So I was shocked by the end of the retreat to discover that the interviews with nearly every German student who came to me were about struggle and anger and self-judgment, while most of the French students were plagued by existential questions of doubt and motivation. And for the Italian students, the interviews and meditations were filled with emotion. They came in passionately, gesticulating about how painful and beautiful and difficult and wonderful the process had been, every single one of them. Every individual was singular, but each was also conditioned by a greater cultural whole. Emotional awakening, then, is not about becoming a different person. We may naturally be an introvert or an extrovert, a joyful person or an impatient one. Dzongsor Khyentse Rinpoche goes so far as to say, "Sometimes a master can be a great teacher, but not necessarily a great person. Perhaps he or she is short-tempered not easy to get along with, or makes many demands. When Ram Dass was asked, after his years of spiritual discipline, whether he had transformed his personality, he laughed and answered no. Instead, he said he had become a connoisseur of my neuroses. Like our gender, hair color and height, personality and temperament are given to us for this life. They may be damaged in our childhood and redeemed with inner work, but they are part of our nature. In Buddhist psychology, personality types remain after awakening, but are ennobled by a wise and compassionate heart. There are desire temperaments, aversion temperaments, deluded temperaments. Yet each may become refined through awakening to express a love of beauty, clarity, and spaciousness. Nor is humor excluded. So when Joshu Sasaki Roshi, now the senior Rinzai Zen master in the West, was asked why he came here to teach, he replied, "I didn't come to America to teach. I came to America to have a good time. I want Americans to learn how to truly laugh." There are many ways we have been taught to fear our emotions, and many misconceptions that trap us in this fear. The trauma, judgment, fear, and shame we encounter in childhood can be terribly constricting. Sometimes we imagine that spiritual quietude is the best answer. Don't feel too much. Don't get excited or angry, or you'll rock the boat to enlightenment. Spiritual practice gets mixed up with ideas of passivity and self-effacement, a cessation of passionate aliveness. Even sincere practitioners can mistake a false outer decorum for the peaceful demeanor of inner freedom. We may secretly believe that if we truly allow ourselves to experience our feelings and desires, our self-indulgence will run rampant, or our aggression and indolence will overwhelm us. In thinking this, we confuse our true nature with the feelings of deficient and small sense of self. For while emotions are indeed powerful forces, it is not fear and repression that will release their grip. Awareness is the answer. We fear the destructive power of our emotions when we haven't seen them for what they really are. We confuse allowing ourselves to be aware of them with the necessity to act them out. But to include our full selves in our journey, we need to understand how we have been entangled by and identified with our emotions. We need to see the identity of the body of fear, to see how the hurt and frustration of childhood, the forces of anger, greed, pride, sexual longing, and need have been conditioned in us. Experiencing the full range of these feelings as they come and go in our consciousness, we can begin to ask of each the question, "Is this who I am?" If we can hold our feelings in a spacious and fearless heart, the lonely, broken, spiteful, confused feelings arise in a new way, transformed by our acceptance. Weeping Buddha, Wrathful Buddha. We armor and defend the heart not only against the world, but against ourselves. Some of us fear sadness, others fear joy, some fear weakness, others fear strength. There's a cartoon showing two generals striding down the halls of the Pentagon. One is whispering to the other, "Last night I had a real nightmare. I dreamed the meek inherited the earth." Unlike the Pentagon, the awakened heart is undefended. It allows the full sorrow and beauty of life. Lama Chogyam Trungpa said, "It is this open and tender heart that has the capacity to transform the world." When a society has lost its ability to feel its grief, to mourn the dead of its battles, the wasted lives of youth in its ghettos, the loss of pristine forests and noble values, the racist warehousing of men in its vast prisons, it closes some part of its heart to hope. If we cannot grieve, we cannot take the lessons of the past and use them to open our hearts to new love. In Japan, Jizo Bodhisattva is one of the manifestations of this open heart. Like Saint Christopher, Jizo is the protector of travelers and children. He is a saint of grief and renewal. Zen teacher Yvonne Rand has adapted a Jizo ceremony offered for parents of water babies, children who were stillborn or aborted, even if their losses occurred in the distant past. In the ceremony, parents offer prayers and sew tiny robes for these lost children, placing the robes ceremonially on the childlike figure of Jizo in the temple garden. An astonishing amount of unacknowledged tears and grief pour out of the parents who attend, many of whom had no idea how much was held in their heart. In the same way, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial has become a public altar for the grief and loss of that war. It is one of the few places in America where one can see grown men weep in public. Asian Buddhist temples are filled with figures of peaceful Buddhas, but also there are weeping Buddhas and wrathful Bodhisattvas, figures with flaming swords, each expressing the power of emotions after awakening. Even masters like Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama admit occasional bouts of anger. When the 1991 U.S. bombing of Iraq evoked in him the horror of Vietnam, at first Thich Nhat Hanh felt so angry he canceled his American teaching schedule. He writes that it took him several days to breathe and calm his heart and transform the anger into grief and the power of fierce compassion so that he could come to America and speak passionately to the root of the problem. The Dalai Lama has written, "In situations of great injustice, I can get angry for a time, but then I think, what is the use? And gradually this anger turns into compassion." His teachings acknowledge that great strength is needed to act in this world, but the wrathful Buddhas wield the sword not of hatred, but of a powerful compassion. Both collectively and individually, there are times to use this sword skillfully. I saw a Korean Zen master use his strength of compassion with a senior student who had fallen in love with a new female student in the community. Less than a year later, this woman abruptly left the senior student for another man. For several months, the Zen master was sympathetic to his senior student's grief and ministered to his sorrow. Then the master took a 9-month teaching trip to Europe and Korea. Upon his return, he spent time checking in with each of the community members. When his senior student let him know he was still mourning his loss, the Zen master reached into his bag and pulled out an exquisitely carved set of prayer beads as a gift. He carefully placed them in the delighted student's two hands, which he held with one of his own. Then, in an instant, the master raised his other hand and fiercely smacked the student across the face, shouting as he did, "Put her down!" Then the master bowed and walked away. All of us standing there were in shock. But we all soon noticed that the senior student was dramatically changed by this blow. He let go and moved on with his life. With the strength of heart, we can respond to the full range of human emotions, unafraid of feelings, neither identified with nor embattled by them. When we accept the feelings as impermanent and impersonal forces, we can be free to honor them without being shut down or frightened or caught by them. Wilhelm Reich once pointed out to a patient who was trying hard not to feel, "You have a mask." The woman replied, "But Dr. Reich, you have a mask too." He answered, "Yes, that is true, but the mask hasn't me. Ordinary perfection. In mature spirituality, we have to find perfection in non-perfection. The Zen founder Seng San teaches that enlightenment dawns only when we are without anxiety about non-perfection. We meet the world with our hearts as it is, unafraid of its beauty and its blemishes. We trust in the body, the emotions, in life itself as it unfolds. Our struggle to become someone different, to grasp after an imagined happiness, drops away. As the Tibetan sage Gendun Rinpoche puts it, only our searching for happiness prevents us from seeing it. It is like a vivid rainbow which you pursue without ever catching it, or a dog chasing its own tail. Although peace and happiness do not exist as an actual thing or a place, they are always available and accompany you every instant. Waiting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you open and relax this tight fist of grasping, infinite space is there, open, inviting, and comfortable. Make use of this spaciousness, this freedom, and natural ease. Don't search any further. Don't get into the tangled jungle looking for the great enlightened elephant who is already resting quietly at home in front of your own hearth. Robert Fulghum, the author of All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, describes coming to the end of a difficult practice period in the 1960s at a famous Rinzai temple in Kyoto. He had a last interview with the abbot, Zen Master Kohara Roshi. Instead of focusing only on the meditation or koan practice, the master emphasized that there was nothing to become. Then he spoke about his own life, about the stress involved in running such a large old temple, about the poor quality of the young priests, about his difficulties in fundraising and dealing with my wife and children who are not, he smiled, as holy as I am. He went on, sometimes I would like to get a little place in Hawaii and just play golf. He smiled again. It was this way before I was enlightened, you know, and now it's the same after enlightenment. After a suitable pause for Fulghum to digest this wisdom, the master bade him to go home, where, according to the author, he had been a thirsty man looking for a drink and all the while standing knee-deep in a flowing stream. Without the understanding of ordinary perfection, spirituality can put us at odds with our life. The images we've been taught about perfection can be destructive to us. It is like the Eskimo hunter who asked the missionaries, if I did not know about God and sin, would I still go to hell? No, said the priest, not if you didn't know. Then why, asked the Eskimo earnestly, did you tell me? Ordinary perfection is being true to ourselves, to the way things are. Do we go into the garden wishing that the pansies were taller than the daffodils, or thinking that the roses would be fine if only they didn't have thorns? Do we go into a kindergarten and wish that the children would fit into some model of perfection we hold? Or can we see that variety makes the beauty of gardens and humans? That our spiritual task is not to make perfection, but to awaken to the perfection around us. As one senior lama has said, perfection must be around here somewhere. Where is it? Is it the next experience or the one after that? My true practice is patience, not wanting anything special or unusual to happen. As soon as I see striving and expecting, I know I've lost the great perfection. The hardest thing I still have to pass through is the realization that there is no final perfect condition to rely on. It is all fundamentally insecure, changing, you know. You don't learn this quickly. You have to let go into this ordinary perfection again and again. There's a modesty in this ordinary human perfection. We need to acknowledge both our gifts and our foibles, whoever we are. Who among us has not struggled with his or her own humanity? Instead of clinging to an inflated, superhuman view of perfection, we learn to allow ourselves the space of kindness. There's beauty in the ordinary. We invite the heart to sit on the front porch and experience from a place of rest the inevitable comings and goings of emotions and events, the struggles and successes of the world. Beyond praise and blame. The Tao teaches that when we make good, we also make bad. When we make right, we also make wrong. Instead of judging, we might let the weary heart rest. This is the freedom of the Tao. It goes on. Do you want to improve the world? I don't think it can be done. If you tamper with it, you will ruin it. If you treat it like an object, you'll lose it. The master sees things as they are, without trying to control them. She lets them go their own way and resides at the center of the circle. Within the mind of ordinary perfection, praise and blame, success and failure, pride and self-judgment are recognized as imposters, second-hand opinions about our experience. A tremendous relief arises when we finally step beyond praise and blame. In the resulting liberation of heart and action, many things become possible. Here's one example of such a liberation. In parts of India where there's a scarcity of doctors, villages sometimes pool their money in order to send their youth to college and medical schools, to later return as healers to the community. In one poor mountain town, there's a sign outside a doctor's office which reads, "Dr. V. S. Krishna, M.D., failed, Calcutta Medical College." This meant that Dr. Krishna had attended medical school in Calcutta, but he had not passed his exams. Nevertheless, he had returned home and opened an office, telling the truth about his degree and offering whatever medical knowledge he had gained. His office was a busy one. Perhaps all of us are a bit like Dr. Krishna. Our human life includes both considerable successes and failures. If we allow ourselves to be caught up by feelings of either shame or pride, we will limit the scope of what we might do and who we might be. Most spiritual teachers have found that becoming independent of praise and blame is a long process. We begin with only moments. Then, with practice, we can gradually extend to hours and days of being free from the judgment of others or ourselves. We learn to let judgment rise and fall without getting caught in it. We see how much bigger and more amazing life is than we had believed. There comes a rest, a freedom when we experience the dance of life without critical thoughts of how it should look. It's like the man who was mailed this note by his furniture company. "Dear Mr. Jones, what would your neighbors think if we had to send a truck to your house to repossess all that furniture you have still not finished paying for?" They got the following reply: "Dear sirs, I have discussed the matter with my neighbors to find out what they would think. They all think it would be a dirty trick of a mean company they would not want to patronize again either. Sincerely yours, Mr. Jones." To live outside of praise and blame does not mean we will not make mistakes. At 76, Ruth Denison is one of the most respected teachers of insight meditation in the West. In recent years, her husband, a lifelong Dharma student, developed Alzheimer's, to the extent that he would wander out of the house not knowing where he was. For months, Ruth regularly drove 4 hours back and forth from her retreat center to her home, staying up all hours to care for him. One day, he left the stove unattended and part of the house burned down. During this period, she was invited to Portland, Oregon, to give a lecture and lead a retreat. Arriving exhausted, she entered the room of 150 students gathered for the teachings. She began by encouraging them to feel their breath and body, to know directly their present experience. She talked about being mindful of what's going on. Then she told the story of her husband's Alzheimer's and the recent fire. She continued to teach about awareness. Then she said, "Did I tell you about my husband and the fire?" and proceeded to tell the story all over again. She spoke further about attention, and after some time said, "Oh, I have to tell you about my husband and the fire we had," and began for a third time to tell the story. Many in the room became frightened and upset for this woman who, it appeared, was beginning to show signs of Alzheimer's as well. Several people stood up to leave. Before they reached the door, Ruth called out, "Wait, you meditation students there, where do you think you're going? I want you to look at your expectations. What were you expecting when you came?" Some moments passed as they stood reflecting. Then she continued, "Tonight, you have a chance to observe something special. You have a chance to see a senior Dharma teacher fail. I don't even know what I just said." And they sat back down, and Ruth continued to teach. "Can you be awake to whatever is happening? That is your practice." Fortunately, Ruth's memory loss was only for that night and only due to exhaustion. As soon as she got some rest, her memory and energy came back full force. But that evening, she had demonstrated true presence, the ability to stay with anything, even her own disorientation, and allow it to be held in awareness and compassion. Becoming eccentric. When the emotions are free and the heart can express itself without concern for the opinion of others, that freedom extends to every aspect of our character. If you were to meet Ruth Dennison, you might see her as an eccentric old woman. When we look honestly at the community of spiritual teachers, we find them in general to be an eccentric lot. Some are strangely hermit-like, some publicly flamboyant. Some are part of the spiritual jet set, the Dharma glitterati, while others are Dharma nerds. Some are slow and mindful, others passionate and excitable. There is no proper single model. Eccentricity means uniqueness, finding the freedom to be utterly one's own person. Even if outwardly we do not appear different, inwardly there is the fearless ability to be wholly the embodiment of yourself. The painter George Braque once exhorted those around him, "It is up to us to be real strong eccentrics and not to waver." One Zen master called this the culmination of Zen training, its fruition, to be faithful to yourself and to life. On one hand, we center ourselves in Zen so that we are not lost in the power of greed, hatred, and ignorance. This is a purifying process of letting go until we let go fully. But then we need to return and be authentic, absolutely true to our own life. Ajahn Sumedho, the Western monk who has established half a dozen monasteries in Thailand and the West, recalls his first term as an abbot. "I didn't really know what I was doing nor how I was supposed to act. So I tried to be just like my teacher, and because I admired him so much, I tried to run the monastery in just the way that he did. But it didn't work. It was a disaster because I'm not him. And then I realized that what people admired in him was that he was just himself. So I discovered that that's what I had to do, to be myself." Because spiritual teachers are often charismatic, and traditions are compelling, in the beginning spirituality can involve a lot of imitation. This is natural for a time. but it can become rigid. If we think spiritual means to be quiet and unruffled, we might imitate this with blandness. On the other hand, if the master is licentious and drunken, we can find communities of alcoholics, disciples trying to show their wildness in exactly the same way. These all become forms of spiritual materialism. Unfortunately, the spiritual world can become as confining and narrow-minded as the rest of our culture. It seems that almost every religion and spiritual community has its unconscious groupthink, its in-group behavior. Sister Claire, an old Catholic nun, sadly described how during her first years as a nun, "It wasn't my inner life that mattered at all to the church. It was only my decorum and belief." And in a Hindu community, where everyone believed they had found the best way, a student who finally left commented, "We were trying so hard to be Hindus, we forgot to be ourselves." As E.E. Cummings put it, "To be nobody but yourself in a world which is doing its best to make you everybody else means to fight the hardest human battle ever and to never stop fighting." While emotional, physical, and mental freedom is not imitative, it is also not its opposite, the acting out of unconscious needs and fears. Like Ram Dass, who became the connoisseur of his neurosis, we come to know ourselves as we are, but without indulgence or self-pity. When we are truly aware of our feelings, while not being bound by their energies, we can choose. No matter what the circumstances, we are free to follow our wisdom. The person who has tasted real liberation embraces the richness of life as a whole. We find this broad perspective in the wisest of human tales, from the Ramayana to Shakespeare, from the Jataka tales to the Bible. There's a joy in this freedom like no other. Trudy Dixon, who edited Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, offered this characterization of the freedom her teacher Suzuki Roshi represented. The qualities of his life are extraordinary: buoyancy, vigor, straightforwardness, simplicity, humility, serenity, joyousness, uncanny perspicacity. But in the end, it is not the extraordinariness of the teacher which perplexes, intrigues, and deepens the student. It is the teacher's utter ordinariness. Because he is just himself, he is a mirror for his students. In his presence, we see our original face, and the extraordinariness we see is only our own true nature. Happiness of Being. Japan's most beloved Zen poet, Ryokan, was known for being unpretentious and wise. Like St. Francis, he was a lover of simple things, of children and nature. In his poems, he writes openly of his tears and loneliness during long winter nights, of his heart leaping with spring blossoms, of his losses and regrets, and of the deep trust he has learned. His emotions flow freely, like the seasons. When people ask him about enlightenment, he offers them tea. When he goes to the village for alms food and to offer teachings, he usually ends up playing with the children. His happiness lies in being at peace with himself. He wrote, "Today's begging is finished. At the crossroads, I wander by the side of the Buddhist shrine, talking with some children. Last year, a foolish monk. This year, no change." The emotional wisdom of the heart is simple. When we accept our human feelings, a remarkable transformation occurs. Tenderness and wisdom arise naturally and spontaneously. Where we once sought strength over others, now our strength becomes our own. Where we once sought to defend ourselves, we laugh. Allowing room for our dependency and needs brings forth a hidden wholeness. Happiness and love come naturally in letting go of fear. They bubble up like spring water. They spread throughout our being. Ajahn Jumnian, one of my teachers from the jungles of the Malay Peninsula, brings this spirit when he comes to teach in America. An orange-robed ball of vitality, with endless good humor and a shining heart, he speaks only a few words of English. When he is without a translator, his teachings are very simple. "Empty, empty," he will say. "Happy, happy." He opens his arms as if embracing all the world and says again, "Empty, empty. Happy, happy." He knows all things arise and vanish like a dream. They change. They cannot be possessed. Accepting this truth, he moves through the world gracefully and is happy. One spiritual teacher tells the story of an African-American woman who participated in her year-long training group. This woman had experienced a lifetime of trauma, poverty, abuse, the death of a parent, racism, illness, a divorce from a painful marriage, and single parenting two children. These difficulties poured out of her soul in the course of the group, how she had struggled for years to educate herself, struggled to fight for justice, to gradually find her way. The others in the group told their stories of difficulties as well, the pain and the challenges, the many ways they had struggled. Finally, at the last meeting, this woman announced, "After all I've been through, all the troubles I lived through, I'm going to do something really radical. I'm going to be happy." When we understand that freedom of the heart is a possibility for us too, we can awaken to our own happiness wherever we are.
This concludes tape 4 of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry with Jack Kornfield. Our program continues with tape 5.